Today, we're joined by David H. Friedman, a science journalist and author covering health, business, policy, and societal changes with a special focus on exploring trends that impact population health. He writes for publications including Inc., Politico, Scientific American, and The Atlantic. David, thanks for joining us today.
No, it's great to be here.
So, look, first question. A lot of authors, the middle initial H, why is that necessary in David Friedman?
It's incredibly necessary for David Friedman, far more than for most names. I am just constantly shocked on a monthly basis by how many talented David Friedmen spring up around the world. There's a fairly well-known racehorse owner in Australia called David Friedman. There's a brilliant neuroscientist here in the U.S. Called David Friedman, and on. So I was hoping the H would distinguish me. Sadly, some brilliant David H. Friedmans have popped up besides me. So I'm going to have to come up maybe with another middle name or a nickname or something.
Fair enough. Okay. So we're going to talk about a few topics today, including a book that you wrote a few years ago called Wrong that I had the chance to read and very much enjoyed, along with some of your recent articles. But just for people who are unfamiliar with you, do you want to just provide a little bit of background on yourself of, you know, how you started out your writing and how you've gotten into, you know, this market segment of battling modern ideas, I guess, to a large degree?
It would certainly be easy enough for me to provide you with some sort of narrative that made it sound like this was a brilliant quest on my part, and that this was a rational set of choices that led me down this path. But in fact, I just sort of followed my curiosity all along and zigged and zagged and almost stumbled into this issue of realizing that really so much of what we hear from experts just doesn't hold up over time. And this struck me as really important in everything I was doing, not just the book Wrong, but most of my articles, because as a journalist, typically what I'm doing is quoting experts and passing on their wisdom to readers, often millions of readers. And I was just horrified to discover that in the long run, most of what I was sharing with readers just wasn't holding up over time. And I decided to sort of devote much of my career to figuring out what was going on there, in part so I could do better.
So where does this even start with? You know, I mean, you begin to have the opportunity as a journo to speak to people. Where do you even begin to start to question their evidence? Because this is, you know, it's one of the first topics that you address is when you talk to someone who is, you're told, is an expertise or a leader in their field, you oftentimes wouldn't think to question their judgment or their findings.
Almost by definition of an expert, in a way, that's sort of what an expert is, someone who's supposed to know and know a lot more than the rest of us. And I think by and large, experts do know more than the rest of us. It still doesn't mean they're going to be right, even though they may have more information and they've thought about it more and they may be smarter about many of us and some of these questions, they still manage to come out with the wrong answers. And really, the starting point for me was in looking at some of the basic questions that I had investigated as a journalist. Simple things like, how do you make a successful business? What's a great leader? I've done a lot of business writing. I've done a lot of science writing. And how do we explain basic things in our universe, you know, from what are black holes and what about the expansion of the universe, and all the way to more mundane questions in everyday life, such as, does it make sense to be well organized? That was something I looked at. Again and again, I discovered that whatever the conventional wisdom was, over time, it got overturned. And new ideas came up that seemed incredibly right, and they would become overturned over time as well. And so finally, in being confronted with all this overturning of what had seemed pretty solid expert opinion, I decided to really take a look at sort of the foundations of what it is that experts do and why their results simply don't hold up.
Has this always been a position that you've had? And what I mean by that is, because you write, you know, within science, it sort of lends itself to being critical in that idea of having a hypothesis and testing it out. So from historically during your writings, have you always tried to examine things from a bit of a critical nature before accepting them, or is this just a gradual process of seeing all these pillars of understanding collapse over time?
I would say it's more the latter. It's not that really I had some amazing insight that led me to always question what was going on. I think journalists tend to get pushed in one of two directions. They either get pushed into writing about what it is that their audience wants to hear. And I think that's a trap that probably most journalists fall into, including me. And the other trap journalists fall into, I think, is trying to look at what it is that people think they know and then come up with something surprising. And the reason is nobody really wants to read a bunch of stuff that they felt they already knew that just repeats what they believed anyway. People want to be surprised. Or they want to have their ideas validated with new evidence. And I think I fell into those traps as well for most of my career. And it was really about 10 years ago that I sort of became surprised by the idea that, in fact, there was something else going on here and that there was a more sort of broader wrongness underlying just about all expert opinion.
There's a lot of terms used in these books and in this book rather. We'll go through them. So I'm just looking through some of my notes, and you know, this one place is as good as another to start off. But one of the things that you talk about within this book is you begin to explain how expert communities or groups of experts can begin to inherently make the data worse. Can you provide an overview of how that begins to happen?
I call this this phenomenon survival of the wrongest. So one of the things I wanted to do in writing the book Wrong was take a look at what our most trusted experts say and how they go wrong. And in my opinion, our most trusted experts, our most trustworthy experts are scientists. I've always had a little bit of, or maybe a lot of, science worship in me. I'm probably a wannabe scientist deep down, although I don't have any advanced degrees. And yet I've always really put a lot of faith in what scientists have to say. And as part of my book, I wanted to look at how even scientists go wrong. And so I thought that would be the hardest part of my book to write. And so I decided I would try to get that over with first by trying to somehow make the case that these brilliant people, who obviously were right the vast majority of the time, or so we all think, how do even they screw up sometimes? And when I started asking scientists, I almost always got the same answer, which is, what are you talking about? We're usually wrong. That's how science works. Science is all about being wrong all the time, and you try to learn from it, you prove yourself wrong, you prove others wrong, and then you try to find something that maybe does a better job of being right until you prove that wrong. And the amazing thing is nobody ever asks that of scientists. And I never had. If you look at all the science articles and books you can find, rarely does anyone come up with the question of, are you guys usually right? Because if you ask scientists, they'll generally tell you, no, we're not. And this happens on a community level. And let me tell you how this happens, because this is fascinating. So a scientist comes up with an idea. Now, ideas are a dime a dozen in science. What science is about is testing ideas. And when scientists test ideas, either they prove their ideas right, well, they can't prove them right, I should say. They either manage to prove them wrong, or they fail to prove them wrong, in which case maybe the idea is a pretty good one and it can survive. Well, typically, most ideas that scientists have turn out to not be right. Why is that? Because scientists are always looking for new ideas, interesting ideas, surprising ideas, helpful ideas. These ideas, by their very nature, surprising, new, novel ideas, are usually wrong because if they were right, we probably already would have discovered them. We've kind of already figured out the easy right stuff. And most of what's facing science now is hard stuff. And so most of their guesses are wrong. And what happens is when you have a new idea, a bunch of scientists around the world will test it. And most of them will correctly manage to prove that it's wrong. However, testing is hard, and usually some team of scientists will screw up in some way, not because they're sloppy or they're bad, but just because that's the nature of the game. It's hard to do it right. Einstein screwed up a lot of the time in some of his testing. So when a scientist correctly proves an idea wrong, they just move on. Generally, it's not publishable, because people don't want to read about an idea that didn't pan out. They want to know what's right. And that's even true in scientific journals. But when a team of scientists incorrectly proves that something is not wrong, that it may be right, that's interesting. And so that will get published before all the correct tests that find the idea wrong get published. And so as a result, among this community effect of scientists, it's the worst testing that tends to get the most attention. And so in a way, whatever the problems with individual scientists, it just gets worse among the community of scientists. And then, of course, journalists look for the most interesting, surprising ideas in scientific journals. So we take the worst of scientific journals, and that's what we give the headlines to. And so by the time the public gets a scientific idea, you're seeing the absolute tip of the pyramid of terrible work, of things that are most likely to be wrong. And in that way, this is sort of a crowd effect.
There are some further underlying factors in this, and I can't remember if this is discussed in the book, but it's something that does get talked about from time to time. It's the idea now of scientists having to demonstrate their value when it comes to funding the research that they want to do outside of the media trying to grab headlines. Is there more pressure on the scientific community, as you said, to provide hard evidence that when they're getting grants and funds to come up with something? Is this an issue of why they're forced to constantly put out research that perhaps hasn't been as vigorously tested as it should?
Yes, is the short answer. I don't think scientists, I think very rarely do scientists purposely fudge or misrepresent their work or purposely do something insufficiently or sloppily in order to get a grant, because in the long run, that would work against them. It might work to get a grant, but then when it didn't pan out, they'd have a lot of trouble getting the next grant. But as funding shrinks and the cost of doing research goes up, there's tremendous competition among scientists. All scientists feel more pressure to do something to get funding. And typically what funders want is some sort of payoff. Now, I don't mean necessarily a financial payoff. That's certainly not true of government funding in most cases. But let's say, for example, in the biological sciences, what government funders typically look for, or foundation funders, is some sort of health advancement. And they want to see evidence that there's going to be a health advance. So sometimes scientists who want to do fundamental research where it might not pay off in an obvious or at least a quick way in terms of health advances may end up, whether consciously or unconsciously, skewing the way they present things and the kinds of ways they test their theories to make it seem more plausible that there's going to be some sort of concrete and rapid health advancement as a spinoff from their research. So that can definitely increase the amount of wrongness, the rate of wrongness that you see, because they're forced to kind of push their research in a direction that it isn't most easily pushed in. And yes, that clearly can cause scientists to get off track.
And that's a bit conflicting of what you're saying, because originally you had said, you know, scientists don't start out with a predetermined outcome. But the whole basis of, you know, this book and what we're talking about is that there's oftentimes an inherent bias in the reason of why you're undertaking these studies a lot of the time is to solve a problem. So it sounds conflicting what you're telling me. How does a scientist try to stay neutral when oftentimes the purpose behind doing this exercise is for a desired outcome half the time?
So you're absolutely right. There's tremendous conflict and inconsistency in what's going on. There's tremendous tension within science of being pulled in different directions. So it certainly some scientists set out to solve a problem. That's their goal, and they really want to solve it. And that's a certain kind of bias. I want to get to this endpoint. And it might be a very noble one, such as I want to cure this disease. But if they go in to their research with the hope and intent of getting a result, that's inevitably going to skew much of the way they look at the problem. It's going to influence the questions they ask, the way they measure things, the types of studies they do, the way they interpret the data they get, the way they present it. And so there is a real bias there, and that's a problem. On the other hand, many scientists, probably most, are more interested in investigating a question rather than coming up with a certain answer. They'd love for the answer to be helpful and interesting, but they really want to explore the question. And that's a different kind of bias. You might say a more open-minded kind of bias, perhaps towards whatever is most interesting, whatever might help them get published, whatever might get them the next grant. And so there isn't one kind of bias. Now, we're talking about scientists being biased. As you point out correctly, they're not supposed to be. However, if you ask scientists, are you biased? The vast majority of them will say, yes, of course I am. I can't help it. I'm a human being. We're all biased. The best I can do is to try to identify the way I'm biased and to try to avoid falling into the trap of feeding that bias. I think most scientists do a pretty decent job at it, probably better than most of us do in our own professions, but they're not perfect, and they would admit that. And bias is a real problem in science, as it is in much of life.
There are a number of terms and factors used in the book, and I guess it's probably a good place to cut into that. So, you know, you mentioned that when experts examine information, how they can avoid issues like correlation is not causation as a theory. So, look, very briefly, do you want to just, I guess, just explain that for people who might not understand what that is, but more importantly, for our conversation, explain how that applies to a lot of the research that people are undertaking?
Correlation and causation people tend to learn even before they go to graduate school to become a scientist. It's so incredibly well known in the scientific community from even the most beginning science student. And yet it's a problem that scientists, even professional, tenured, highly respected scientists fall prey to all the time. And the idea is if you're making observations to try to answer a question or investigate an issue in science, just because you notice that every time A happens, B seems to happen as well, that doesn't mean that A causes B. It may be that B causes A. It may be there's a factor C that causes both of them at the same time. And yet all the time we see this every day in journal articles and certainly in newspapers and magazines, we see people making that mistake. If you eat a certain kind of food, people seem to be healthier. I mean, a classic one, I think, is people who exercise tend to live longer and be healthier. There's a huge problem in proving causation there, that the exercise causes the good health. Now, it probably does. I think most people believe it does. But it's very hard to prove. It's possible that people who are healthier feel better, have more energy and vigor, so they're more likely to exercise. So this is one of these fundamental problems, a trap in science that people still fall into, even though everybody knows about it and claims to avoid it.
That's really interesting, because that is one of the very particular issues that probably wouldn't be questioned. I would call that assumed knowledge that that healthy people live longer. So this can really stretch into a number of things, because correlation is not causation. At its core, like, that argument can be taken across anything. Like, if the research isn't specific enough, that idea can begin to creep into virtually any argument, can it not?
It does, and it does creep into most of our arguments. Everybody likes to cite evidence. You know, it's interesting. Everybody who gets in an argument, we see this in politics now all the time, but it happens in science. It happens in every field and every profession. People get in these deep arguments, and they fall into two or more camps. And both sides will claim that ones who are to the facts and the other side isn't. Well, you know, typically both sides are in fact enlisting facts, or what they believe to be facts, but they're probably cherry-picking facts. They're not picking facts in an unbiased way, and they're drawing unwarranted conclusions from those facts. And they don't even notice when they like how the argument ends up. If the argument is in their favor, then they tend to be blind to the ways in which they're misusing those facts, finding causation where there really isn't good grounds for it. But you spot it very clearly in the other side. It's sort of like everybody thinks religion is stupid except for their own religion. It's very easy for people to make fun of everybody else's thinking, but they tend to be completely blind to the problems with their own thinking. That wasn't a knock on religion, by the way. It's just an observation. People tend to be brilliant at criticizing everybody else's religion, but are stunned and appalled when their own religion is criticized.
And going back to factors in the book, you mentioned things like theory of gamemanship. And if I'm not mistaken, I think you were looking at a comparison between football quarterbacks in Tom Brady and Kurt Warner. Do you remember the comparison or where that came out of?
Yes. Well, and gamesmanship applies to everything, including scientists. But certainly the case of Tom Brady is incredibly interesting. Look, I mean, America is really a football crazy nation, you know, that is U.S. football. And it's certainly our professional leagues have armies, vast armies of super experienced people whose lives are dedicated to spotting talent in college and even high school players to try to develop them as players for your team. Tom Brady, who now people is one of the greatest football players of all time, probably the greatest quarterback of all time. I'm trying not to be biased here. I do live in Boston, so his team represents my area, and I'm a big fan. But as much as other parts of the country may resent him, he's generally recognized as one of the greatest football players of all time. He was almost completely ignored by all of those so-called scouts when he was a college player. He barely got picked at all. He barely made it into the professional leagues. And even after he did, he barely played. He sat on the bench for most of the time. And when he finally made it into a game, it sort of took the world by storm that here was this phenomenal talent that nobody managed to notice. And so the question becomes, well, what is it they're looking for? I mean, these scouts are supposed to know and spot this kind of thing. How can these people who are at the very top of their profession not miss such an extraordinary show of skill among someone who had been playing at this point for 5 years in a national spotlight and no one saw it? So, I mean, I think that's a stunning example of how experts simply get it wrong.
So what was going on? Like he just went unnoticed, or again, this bias that is inherent within most people was causing them to overlook him?
Yes. And nobody has a really good explanation really of why he was overlooked. I think the reason is it's really much harder than people think to make these kinds of decisions. People assume that an expert is equipped with exactly the right questions and observational skills that will enable them to clearly say, this player is going to make it and this one isn't. Certainly you expect some people to be on the fence. I mean, that's fine. Tom Brady was not such a case. Tom Brady was clearly someone with extraordinary skills, possibly more than any other human being has ever had in this game of football. And he was completely missed. How? Well, were people looking at him at the wrong time? Were they imposing certain interpretations of what they saw on the field? He was breaking records in college. He was phenomenal in college, and yet it still didn't impress on people enough. They seemed to be focusing on what they saw as his flaws. For example, he's not very fast. He wasn't very strong. He wasn't a big player the way they like to see football players. So those were some of his weaknesses. They seemed to focus on those and ignore what his clear strengths were. So the basic answer is, who knows how they missed it? They don't know. But it's clear that they did, and it probably happens every day. There may be other Tom Brady's out there, there almost certainly are, that never made it to the big leagues.
And, you know, when we talk about this again, earlier you had mentioned Einstein. So you see this sort of bias in overlooking things. You had mentioned that scientists will throw out inconvenient data, and also cognitive bias can be inherent in the research in order to get the findings. And there was an example that you used of this in the book related to groundbreaking discoveries and also with Einstein's G factor.
Einstein came up with a really interesting theory about fundamental particles at a time when we didn't know much about the properties of things, electrons and neutrons and protons and other fundamental particles, the few we knew about at the time. And he came up with an idea, properties of an electron. Again, it gets a little technical, it's not worth going into, but the point is, he also came up with, and this was interesting about Einstein, not only was he a theorist, famous with ideas for how to test his ideas, and he really understood as well as any scientist ever has that an idea isn't really great unless you can find a good way to try to prove it wrong. And it's only when you come up with a great way to try to prove it wrong and the theory survives that test, that's when the idea is believable. So in coming up with this G factor idea, he also came up with a really clever way to measure it. After all, it's pretty hard to measure something that's the size of a fundamental particle, which can't even come close to seeing it in the most powerful microscope. But he came up with a way of essentially magnifying these properties so it could be measured in the lab with a hanging iron bar. And the experiment was very, very hard to do. And he kept getting results that were all over the place. and that weren't giving him the answer that his theory predicted. So he just kept repeating the experiment over and over again. He kept coming up with different results until finally, after doing this many, many times, he came up with exactly the result he predicted. And he said, good, I finally did the experiment right. I got the answer I was looking for. I've proved my theory. And everyone believed him until other people started to do the experiment. And very few of them could get the same result. And the more they did the experiment, the better they got on it. Most of them kept coming up with a result that was half the result, half the number he kept coming up with, until finally it was clear that Einstein's theory was wrong. He was off by a factor of two. And what had happened to him, the trap he fell into, was sometimes you can influence the result of an experiment simply by deciding when you want to stop. If he had kept going, it would have been obvious to him that he was wrong. But when he, by chance, got the wrong result he was looking for, he said, done, finished, I've got the right answer. And that was an interesting way. It's become sort of a classic example of some of the very subtle ways that scientists can throw off their results through experimentation.
When research becomes assumed common knowledge, it falls into the trap of being groupthink. Do you know, or I think this, if I'm not mistaken, again, I read the book a while ago, there are examples that when theories come out and they're tested and they don't agree with the common knowledge, these unpopular opinions can sometimes be suppressed because of the backlash that occurs against them. Why is it that once we believe something to be true, it's so difficult to be reflective or change our position on these ideas?
There's a very good reason why that's the case. That's something that evolution has built into us. And if it hadn't, we'd be a mess. We wouldn't be able to make our way through the world safely. And the reason is simple. We tend to come up with new ideas all the time, or someone comes up with new ideas. We see things that go against the conventional wisdom constantly. Just walking down the street, you'll see surprising things. And our brain has a filter, which is, look, if you believe something is true, if you believe, for example, in gravity, that when you drop something, it's always going to fall. If I step in front of a bus, I'm going to get badly hurt. If you see something that suddenly, for some reason, seems to call that into question, it's probably a pretty good thing that your first thought isn't going to be, oh, I guess I was wrong about buses. Oh, I guess I was wrong about gravity. What you're probably going to think is, well, there's something wrong with this picture. I probably saw this wrong or I'm interpreting wrong. I'm not just going to throw out what I've come to believe over many years of observation or what many, many experts have told me over time. So this filter is generally a very, very good thing. The fact is, most new, surprising, novel ideas that go against the conventional wisdom, the vast majority of them are wrong. Of course they are. If they were right, we probably would have already discovered them. However, once in a great while, a really novel, surprising, counterintuitive idea that goes against the conventional wisdom, in fact, is right. It is a better idea. Unfortunately, we have no obvious, easy way of telling which is which until you do a lot of testing. So these new ideas that turn out to be right have to come up against that same bias, that same filter as all those really terrible new ideas. And that's a real challenge, not only for scientists, but for all of us in daily life. When do we let go of the things we believe in the face of new evidence? And we should call for a lot of evidence before we let go on something we've believed to be true for a long time. Now, that does mean it sometimes takes too long for a new, good, better idea to break through and overturn the conventional wisdom. And I think the book you were referring to a little while ago is The Structure of Scientific Revolutions by Thomas Kuhn, where in the 1960s, he described this process with lots of great examples of how it takes a long time for scientific ideas and beliefs to be overthrown by new ones. At first, those people are rebels, and they get marginalized. But over time, among growing evidence with more and more champions, they eventually become the new conventional wisdom until they're overthrown. And that's the process. It's a very imperfect one. It's an inefficient one, but we don't know of a better one.
There's one particular example. I think it's a good segue to start moving into, particularly in the American environment or the new left-right partisan politics environment. But before that, one of these issues that particularly stands out to me is the, I wouldn't even say rise, because they're not even, I don't even know if you call them fringe. They seem pretty mainstream these days with anti-vaxxers. Now, my understanding is that there was this story or piece of research came out, maybe in the late 90s in a not as well recognized scientific journal, was overturned within a year or two, but stayed around. And then with the prominence of, I think, Jenny McCarthy's appearance on an Oprah show, really helped this gain traction to where the anti-vax movement is, it's really something that people firmly believe in. And you would call it mainstream, whether or not you buy into any of that science or not.
Yes, it's probably not a majority opinion, but certainly it has a strong following. Certainly here in the U.S. And by the way, that original paper that turned out to be horribly wrong and most people at this point would say fraudulent, actually appeared in a major medical publication, one of the world's most respected, which just goes to show you, doesn't it, Jesse? I mean, we're not just talking about fringe publications when we talk about wrong science. The paper was eventually retracted, but it appeared very prominently and seemed very, very credible at the time. But you're right, that laid the groundwork for this movement, which actually was given steam by people like Jenny McCarthy. Now, I actually, my heart goes out to Jenny McCarthy. So I strongly disagree with her. I think it's really unfortunate that she's influenced so many people. I think she's dead wrong. But Jenny McCarthy is just a mother trying to do right by her kid. And the fact of the matter is, most lay people, most non-scientists, simply don't have the tools for deciding which science is right and which science isn't. We're not trained for it. I'm not trained for it. I've picked up a lot of stuff through decades of talking to thousands of scientists. So I have some advantages over most lay people, but I'm still basically a lay person. And I know very, very well that I do not have the training to sift through scientific papers and decide which ones are right and which ones aren't. It's one of the most important skills that scientists have, is to be able to look at other people's studies and other people's papers and go to conferences and listen to them and listen to conflicting ideas and then make their decision. Often it's a gut feeling as to who's probably on the right track and who isn't. Now, when it comes to vaccinations, at this point, there's an overwhelming amount of evidence that vaccines are perfectly safe, and that all the evidence that seemed to show they weren't safe was simply, in some cases, outright fraudulent, in other cases, simply very, very sloppy.
David, I'm not debating the idea. More of my question is, why is it that one fringe falsified piece of research has seemed to gain so much steam compared to other ideas? I'm certainly not an anti-vaxxer myself, but it is problematic how frequently I am now reading about unvaccinated kids getting ill and how the pseudoscience that I'm going to define a group that stay-at-home mums are reading and why they think that trumps something that's been released by doctors, professionals, or a medical company.
That's a great question. And so the way I see the question is this: why does the public seem to like some claims, some scientific claims, more than others? So given a lot of evidence that vaccines are safe and a little bit of evidence that vaccines are dangerous to infants, why do so many people in the public cling to the small amount of evidence? And the answer is simple. It's a theory that fits in better with their view of the world.
But in what way, though? Because you only have to go back, what, a few decades at most to look at things like polio and smallpox and its eradication. Like, you have to be incredibly willingly ignorant to assume that vaccines cause autism when only, as I said, a few decades ago, there are still people who have yet to pass away in old age who are living in iron lungs because we didn't have vaccines only 4 or 5 decades ago.
Well, I have a lot more sympathy for and empathy with the anti-vaxxers who are the parents of children with autism or children with other developmental challenges, who come away with these really, frankly, silly beliefs. I don't mean to be cruel about it because, as I say, I'm very sympathetic. I understand why they do this. They want to believe that something caused the problem, because if they can point to something that caused the problem, then they can hold out the hope that they can solve the problem with some sort of treatment, or that they can save other parents from dealing with some of the things they've gone through.
But this becomes more of a psychological issue than it is more of around our need for closure then, or understanding as human beings then, would it not be?
Yes, and I'd say that 90% of everything that has to do with the issues of why experts are wrong are psychological issues. Bias is a psychological issue. All these issues are psychological, and it's emotional. In this case, extremely emotional. That's who we are as human beings. And if you don't have the training to decide based on the science, you're going to decide based on the psychology of it. And that's exactly what we see happening here.
And we're starting to move a bit off topic here, but while we're here, I might as well ask you the question. One of the things about autism that I just as an outside viewer that I'll present is, autism seems to, at least in my eyes, perhaps it's the media visibility of it, but do you know anything about it potentially being on the rise? Because things like autism and Asperger's and these sorts of illnesses, you know, going back 20 years, these were not common things, but these seem to be reported on in the media with the commonality of the flu or cancer these days. Are these things on the rise, or are they just more visible in the media now?
There's a big debate about that. The answer isn't in. I shouldn't hazard a guess, but I will say I think a very reasonable point of view to take right now is that it's both. That there's no question. There's much more visibility. Parents are more aware. Pediatricians now routinely screen for it, or certainly should. They certainly did not 30 years ago. So we're finding many, many more cases. However, there is some pretty interesting, hard to refute evidence that there may objectively be more cases. It may have to do, some people think, with the higher average age of parents, particularly of fathers, surprisingly, since it was long believed that a father's age was irrelevant. There's now pretty strong evidence that's not the case. There may be environmental issues. I think the evidence is weaker there. There could be other causes that would actually objectively be raising the number of cases. But I think almost certainly there's diagnosis inflation as well. I don't mean inflation in the sense of shouldn't be diagnosed, but I mean just more diagnosis.
We'll move on to now. When you talk about all this information, I noticed it within myself that I'm starting to get a bit more critical of how this evidence is presented. You know, we can talk about fake news and Democrats and Republicans, but the other area where this presents itself that's very divisive is in the area of environmentalism and climate change. And I've noticed even in myself that I'm starting to become a bit of a denialist in this area now. And that's because I remember, you know, I'm in my late 30s, and even going to school in junior high, the textbooks always described how climate change was imminent and would be absolutely, you know, the destruction of our planet was going to come by 1990, then it was going to be here by 2000, then it was going to be here by what Al Gore said, what, 2010, 2012, then it was the temperature only needs to rise by half a degree Celsius before the oceans completely flood over the world and we live in water world. Now Al Gore is back on tour, and what I'm sure you've noticed over the last 3 or 4 days, there's been another enormous push about how, well, apparently now we only really have 10 years. And then at the same point in time, I'm reading information on both sides that are telling me the ice caps are melting. I'm reading at the same time that they're growing again because of non-man-made climate change, along with cyclical weather patterns that happen every 10,000 years. And perhaps I'm just exhausted, but because I can't physically see it, I'm sort of now beginning to lean to more of the conservative view that maybe there's really nothing going on, and it really is sort of lending itself to a lot of these people that gain subsidies and keep their scientific careers alive by proving, not even proving, but by demonstrating that this exists. And I'm willing to hear otherwise, but frankly, I'm a little bit over the topic, which begs the question, why am I even asking it of you?
Well, look, this is something that even most climate change scientists, most climatologists would say, this is a really hard topic. This a massive amount of data that's hard to interpret. And I first thing I want to say is this is not a great area of expertise for me. It's not one of those things where I've pored over the papers to really look at the details myself and done dozens of interviews. So compared to some other areas, I'm flying a little bit blind here, but let me give you my take on this, which is at this point, one of the things I say in the book and believe is true, still believe it's true, is that one of the ways to tell that something is probably right is when you have a long brewing, overwhelming consensus of experts agreeing. We have reached that point in climate change scientists. You have to look really hard to find maybe half a dozen climatologists who are skeptics about climate change. And there are thousands who are completely locked in to the claim that we are well into man-made climate change. So I see that, and without really even knowing the details, to me that's an alarm bell that there's probably something going on here. But and let me give you a big but first. Having said that, I have looked into this enough to know that there's a phenomenal amount of noise on top of all the data about weather and climate change. It changes without man-made anything. Going back to before there was mankind, we've had all kinds of drastic changes in weather patterns on all scales, over millions of years, over thousands of years, over hundreds of years, over hours. And all this noise can obscure other kinds of trends. If there's man-made change that's superimposed on it, it's against a tremendously noisy field. So I'm a little skeptical when people claim that the data are absolutely rock solid. There's a lot of interpretation here as to exactly what factors are causing which changes. So I think there's a little more play here than the experts like to let on, is my rough sense of it. But I do think we have that consensus at this point that makes me feel it's basically right.
So when you say that, then, if it's all, and again, I've heard the argument, if it's all in agreement, then why are they so committed to the ongoing lie that the end of the world is in a year from now if we don't clean our act? And what I'm asking by that is, because I was never a non-believer. I'm just starting to skew that way because for 30 years they've told me that the end of the world is imminent and it's never happening. It's becoming, to me, very much like those guys who stand on the end of a street with a sign that says, you know, the end is nigh. It's I'm a little bit tired of hearing that tomorrow is going to be the end of the world, and then when it doesn't happen, next year they repeat the same story again.
And yes, and that's discouraging. I would distinguish, though, between those people who are outspoken advocates for action, who make those kinds of predictions, for example, an Al Gore, and someone who is a climatologist, a scientist, who is presenting data and their best interpretations of it. So the two get confused a lot. And I think if you look at what the hardcore scientists are saying in their papers, not what they're saying in press releases intended to get governments to act, or what you're reading about in the newspapers designed to rile people up, but what's really going on in the scientific papers, you don't see these, if we don't do something by 2022, there's no turning back. They don't say this in their papers. They present data and observations and theories and interpretations that suggest that something's going on, and the sooner we do something about it, the better. But they don't even, for the most part, say that some of the weather events we're seeing today are necessarily caused by that. We've seen these kinds of runs of bad weather in the past. So I think they're much more circumspect. And what you're seeing are more advocates, more bias, less scientific word.
So we are sort of spinning now. You know, we've talked about bias, experts, and now we're talking about advocacy. It's the perfect time to sort of bring this into the political environment. Now again, I'm in Australia, so I watch this stuff from far away. But you know, with the election of Trump a couple of years ago, I don't have to tell you. I'm sure you see in the media every day that they've got something against this guy about how he's a Nazi or the most terrible person on planet Earth. When you talk about sort of bias and corruption, what are your thoughts on about how this applies to the media? And importantly, do you think individuals have an ability to filter that out? Because despite what everything Trump was saying on the surface, there was a very, very clear message that voters bought into of why they decided to make him the president.
So you're raising a number of great issues here. So first of all, this is a democracy, and that means the people decide. And if a majority of voters, it isn't even the people, it's voters, if a majority of voters want a certain thing, then that's the government we get. And Trump was elected here in the United States. I mean, there were some, you know, you talk about the Russian thing, so there were some irregularities. But look, there's no denying that somewhere close to half of voters wanted Donald Trump, and for the most part, continue to support him. And in a democracy, that's That's what rules. And for people to act like there's been some sort of tremendous travesty of democracy in the election of Trump, or in his continuing to get his way, then they're just misinterpreting what democracy is. Now, America is very, very polarized right now. The media is also very polarized. Everybody's biased. Everybody is. I can't think of a single media outlet, and I look at all of them, left and right. I can't think of a single one that I truly think of as unbiased. I think everybody is either biased for Trump, and more on the media side, biased against Trump. Now, that doesn't mean you can't pull from this incredibly noisy, biased mess of information that you can't pull truth out of there somewhere. And I think the mistake people make is locking themselves into one particular media or type of media or type of media bias, and that becomes their whole worldview. I think that's a big mistake. I think everybody, regardless of what side you're on, needs to spend more time with a wider range of media so they can make their decision based on that. Everybody presents different facts, different ideas. We need to hear more of them.
But why did it become so I was still living in Canada. I moved over here in 2004. So I remember when Bush was president, and that was dividing when W was president, but certainly not what I can gather with Trump. So I guess rather what my question is, why is there so much hyperbole around him? The right doesn't like Hillary, but there's not chaos in the streets. The left, who don't like Trump, think that this guy is like Satan incarnate on the planet. Why is the vitriol so much more explosive? And, you know, when you talk about being able to see both sides of the equation, why don't they have the common sense, I guess, that the right or other people would say, like, look, let's just wait and see what happens?
Well, I think it's because Trump hits a lot of hot buttons for liberals. I think he does it on purpose. I think it's one reason so many people in America like him. He's treading on sacred cows. There were certain things you just weren't supposed to say in America because liberals would get really upset if you did. And I think that whole so-called political correctness movement has really been picking up steam tremendously in the past decade, especially. So anything that hints at that people can interpret as being racist, anything that hints at something that people can see as anti-feminist, for example, tends to really upset liberals. And I should say I'm a liberal. It tends to upset me too. But I try not to be as biased at looking at this. And Trump was really the first politician in a long time to actually make a sport of that. He does it almost every day. He's not afraid to say this stuff. And I think for a lot of people in America, they're saying it's about time that somebody comes out and says this stuff out loud. We've all been thinking it. Now at last we can say it out loud. We're not going to let the liberals shut us up. And for liberals, they just can't get over the fact that someone dares to say this stuff out loud and isn't having something horrible happen to them because of it. So there's tremendous outrage, really on both sides, being stirred up by Trump. On the liberal side, how dare he say this stuff? On the conservative side, why are you giving Trump such a hard time for saying what we all think is true? So there it is. He creates tremendous emotions on both sides.
Mm. Outside of the book, you write a number of other topics and articles, as we mentioned in your bio at the beginning, across a number of other stories, publications rather. There was one a couple of years ago that you did, and this is, again, it's another topic that's gaining some steam, is the idea of a minimum living wage as technology replaces jobs. From when you wrote that piece a couple of years ago, do you stay on top of that topic, or you know, what do you think of it as this as technology increases in our world and the idea of just giving money to people without the required effort to earn it?
I have stayed on top of this. I think it's one of the most important issues facing the human race right now. Ultimately, it may be the most important question that humankind has ever faced and may ever face, which is basically the complete displacement of most jobs. I think we're rapidly getting to the point where we're really not going to need most human beings to do something in order to produce all the stuff we need in society and provide all the services we need. Software is getting that good. Robots are coming on fast. Pretty much everything most of us ever did, including journalists like me, in the not too distant future, we could imagine computers doing it better than any of us can do it. So what do we do about that?
What are we actually thinking, though? So, and what I mean, are we thinking that with automation and with massive corporates, are we really thinking that eventually we're going to get to a point where McDonald's creates all the food, Walmart provides all the home furnishings, Chevron provides all the oil, and they employ a million people, and the rest of the people are unemployed?
Possibly, although, you know, you mentioned Amazon. Amazon is continually finding ways to replace its workers. As it grows, it overall hires more people. But the percentage of its jobs that are performed by humans actually goes down because they're becoming so efficient. Look, a lot of their employees are drivers. Now we have self-driving cars and trucks that are almost certainly going to be replacing drivers over the next 20 years. They've already automated most of their warehouses, so most of their products are picked by robots. Now, that's been the case for many years at Amazon warehouses. So even if it is just big companies, they're in order to compete, they're going to have to replace most of their human beings, their human workers, with robots and software. So this is going to be a problem that affects most of the human race. And the question is, can we make up for that simply by saying, well, okay, these companies are producing so much wealth by being able to have everything done by robots and software that we'll just tax them at huge rates, maybe a rate of 99.9%, and we'll just distribute most of that wealth to the people who don't have jobs anymore so they can live comfortable lives. Now, I happen to be of the belief that human beings like working one way or another, that they don't feel fulfilled if they can't contribute productively to society. So I don't like that solution, but I do believe we've got to come up with some way of making sure that people don't starve because of being jobless. I prefer ways of making sure they have jobs rather than just giving them money. But we're going to have to do one or the other. There's no question in my mind.
I agree with you on that. I have a real hard time with the idea of handing out money to people who won't work. And I think, as you said, there's a lot of studies about self-worth and value as an individual, and oftentimes in our society that's found through work, which gives us purpose. And I'm quite terrified of the idea of having a population with, you know, absolutely nothing to do, who feel entitled, and then at the same time who, you know, if you're being given a base wage just to wake up and do nothing in the morning, what's it going to take you to be productive?
I agree with most of that. And, you know, I asked the question, well, I mean, we probably, almost all of us would agree, that certainly here in the U.S. and the system in Australia isn't that phenomenally different. You know, the system in the U.S., most people would say, in terms of making sure people who, for whatever reasons, either can't or don't have a job, whatever that is, don't starve. We don't want people starving in the streets. And we have a system in the U.S. for helping poor people and getting them back on their feet and keeping them alive. You know, one of the things I would say is, can't we make that system work? Do we really have to give everybody in America $40,000 a year? Or can't we continue to try to do a better job of just having the government give money to those people who really can't seem to make it in the private sector? There's a lot of belief that a lot of people take that money because they just don't want to work. The evidence doesn't really back that up. There are surely some people who just don't want to work. But in most cases, people who are on the dole, as it's put in the UK, are people who really have trouble finding work. And we have a system for getting them money so they can survive and support their families until they can find work. I think we can do a better job with that system, and I think that makes much more sense than giving everybody money.
All right. Before we wrap up today, back in August, you also did an article on Elon Musk. Was that August? Is that already? That's October. August. Wow, that's a while ago already. Okay. The article sort of addresses the fact of how Silicon Valley is already its own silo, not even within California, but probably the world at large. But this trend of how there's a concentrated amount of wealth and funding in that area, and how companies are not being asked to be profitable in order to get funded to determine what their product is and what service they're going to do, and what that means for our future when we have people dictating what that's going to be without the necessities that we've typically had of supply and demand. Have I encompassed that well enough, I guess, in terms of what you think the article addresses?
Yes, I'd say so. And I think Elon Musk is a great example of what I would say is a sort of pathological arrogance of Silicon Valley. I mean, look, it's been very successful in producing some tremendous startups and businesses. I mean, obviously, Apple Computer and even Amazon, although it's not in Silicon Valley technically. And Tesla is a phenomenal company with a phenomenal product. But on the other hand, in that Silicon Valley, sort of other universe, Elon Musk was able to raise phenomenal amounts of money and sink it into solving problems that would be very hard for other companies to solve because no one's handing them a bunch of money. And so there's not really a lot of rational thought being put into, well, who's being given the resources to try to solve these problems? And it's a sort of power being given to Silicon Valley. And one of the things I point out in that article is one of the things that Silicon Valley tends to try to do with that power is replace as many workers as it can to be more efficient. And Elon Musk has certainly been a leader going far beyond the rest of the car industry in trying to replace auto workers. And so I raise the point of view of, look, Elon Musk one way or another, Tesla one way or another is going to be successful. It absolutely is. The question is that the model we want for a car company, one that uses all robots and software instead of human workers? And I really worry about that.
David H. Friedman, this has been a really good chat. I'll continue to watch your work and we'll find out what other topics we can speak to you about in future.
I look forward to it. Great questions. Really enjoyed it.
Of course. Thank you.